I'd just like to take up something Marcus said earlier about the Southern Poverty Law Center. I don't know how many of you have been down to Montgomery, Alabama.
I used to live there.
But Kevin knows this. It's an old-style city, not too many big buildings. One of the biggest buildings there, great big square block, is the Southern Poverty Law Center. And in fact, right next door to it, there's one of the offices of the State Justice Department, and I was being driven around Montgomery by some lawyers, and one of them used to work in that office, and he said the joke in the office was that they were working in the shadow of poverty. Anyway, race and conservatism. Conservatives don't talk much about race, and I think the historical reasons for this are pretty well known. When the civil rights movement got off the ground in the late 50s, early 60s, the most visible activists running that movement were all leftists. Some of them belonged to left fringe groups. Most of them belonged to the urban, egalitarian, progressive wing of the Democratic Party. And with the assistance of the media, which was mostly leftist, and always has been, this equation got stuck in the public mind, that racial justice equals Democrats. And that generated its own converse in proper Hegelian style, racial injustice equals Republicans. Since most conservatives are Republicans, they think it's best to keep quiet about race for fear of making things worse. That's not quite right, though. Regular mainstream Republicans are not entirely silent about race. Karl Rove, who's a pretty important mainstream Republican, I think we'd all agree. A few weeks ago, I saw him on the telly, up on the podium, addressing the National Council of La Raza. For those of you who are Spanish challenged, La Raza means the race. And he was making a very friendly and conciliatory speech. So it's not quite true that conservatives don't talk about race. They just don't talk about their own race. The association of Republicans and conservatives within Republicans with racial injustice is horribly unfair, as Pat Buchanan points out in his recent bestseller, which I urge you to read. The Democrats were in bed with segregationists for 100 years. And in fact, if you look at the roll calls for the 1964 Civil Rights Act in both houses of Congress, Republicans went about 80-20 for the act. Democrats went about 60-40. So this is really very unfair. But there you are. There's no justice in politics. My boyish good looks may have deceived you. I am actually 61 years old. And I don't say that for the gratuitous pleasure of saying it, although there is a certain pleasure in saying it. I tell you that because I want to tell you that I've seen the civil rights movement all the way through. I remember it. I actually remember having a conversation with my dad. My dad was an old-style racist. He thought black people were inferior, and that was that. And I was a teenage idealist, like as all teenagers are. And I remember having a conversation with my dad at the time of the Little Rock incident, which I think was, what, 59, 58? 58. So I would have been 13 at that time.
57.
Well, I would have been 12. And it just seemed wrong to me that people were being stopped from going to school, and I had a big argument with my dad. But I saw the whole civil rights movement all the way through. And I want to tell you something about the civil rights movement of the early 60s. I'll tell you a thing that's been shoved down the memory hole. Absolutely everybody who supported the civil rights movement, absolutely everybody believed that if it succeeded, the result would be an America in which race didn't matter. It would be an America in which blacks, once the legal restrictions were removed, in which blacks ascended through society and were proportionally represented everywhere. That didn't happen. To say it didn't happen is putting it mildly. Black Americans are about 13%. Is 13% of the population here?
Yeah.
So if the dream, if the civil rights dream, which was my dream as a teenager in England watching the whole thing, quite dispassionately, but I was with them. The dream was that 13% of our doctors and engineers and airline pilots, 13% of our entrepreneurs and contractors and accountants, 13% of our jail inmates and unwed mothers would be black. It would just be proportional everywhere. Why should it not be? We're all one species. We can all accomplish equally. That didn't happen. I think we all know the numbers, and if you don't know them, Jared will be very glad to tell you them. But it's not an across-the-board 13%. And worse than that, even worse than that, I think, blacks and whites have separated out to a large degree. For example, we don't watch the same TV programs. We don't watch the same movies. The guys who run the Hollywood studios know that if they're going to make a nice, light, frothy domestic comedy with somebody like, you know, Tom Hanks or Meg Ryan, they don't need to have any black people in that movie because black people aren't going to watch it. And likewise, the producers of TV sitcoms like Friends or Cheers, they don't have any black people in there because the black people are off watching some other sitcom with all black people in it. You know, this strikes me as awful. That we've separated out like that. It didn't used to be like that. I can remember when it was not like that. So, granted, in some respects, things have got better since 1960. We now have a flourishing black middle class. A capable black American can rise to any position. I do believe that. But somehow, things didn't work out at all the way we hoped. In the same context, I was just looking at Jared Taylor's publication. Not only do we not watch the same TV programs, we don't even use the same names for our children anymore. What was that statistic? I saw a statistic, something like, he would tell you, in California?
In California, in the most recent naming statistics, fully 30% of black girls were given a name that was not given to a single white child. They were all these unusual black names that not a single white child had.
You mean like Shanique, Will, LaShawna, Del
Charlie? That's right. Somehow they're never used by white people.
Well, you know, my mother used to work in the public school system, so I understand those names as well.
I actually have a story about that. I used to live in New York City, in Manhattan. And there was a doctor I used to go and see because I wasn't very well. And he had a great fund of stories. And he told me, I've never checked this, I have no idea if it's true, but it might well be true. He said that the OBGYNs in inner city areas in America, where you get lots of very poor, very young black mothers, so these OBGYNs, one of the chores that they constantly have to do is to dissuade these young, almost illiterate teenage mothers from naming their child Latrine. I have no idea if that's true. Maybe Kevin knows that. I don't know if it's true.
Actually, it is.
Yeah. So the point I'm making is that it all went wrong. It all went horribly wrong. When I look at race in America, and please remember, I'm looking at it through the rose-tinted spectacles of a recent immigrant. I chose to come and live in America. It seemed to me like a very good country to come and live in. And I still have that romantic glow. And I still have high hopes of America. And it distresses me very much when I look back at the hopes that the civil rights movement had, that so much has gone wrong. I feel about race in America the way we all feel sometimes about our own lives. You know, geez, I wish I could just go back to that point and do everything over again, try to get it right. I think there's an element of bad luck there. The civil rights movement came up in the 60s, early 70s, just when all our policymakers and all our intellectual elites were swooning over the idea of social engineering. All of the country was very left-wing there, well, except the offices of National Review. But all the decision-making centres of the country were pretty left-wing back in the 60s, by comparison with today, or with 50 years earlier. And it's kind of bad luck. You know, the policymakers of that time were saying, well, slavery was an evil, we got rid of that with the Civil War. And then up came lawful segregation and Jim Crow, and that was an evil. So we'll get rid of that. How do we get rid of it? We do a whole lot of social engineering. That was really the attitude. And that's why things went right. As a conservative, it seems to me, that's a lot of the reason why things went right. Another point here, just going back to the matter of silence about race among conservatives. All this going wrong, this whole idea of the civil rights movement just going horribly, horribly wrong, has had a very bad effect on white Americans. It's made us very dishonest. And not only that, but it's instilled in us an odd sort of status pecking order. Let me just explain a minute. My background, I was trained as a mathematician, and I kind of do the science beat for magazines that I write for. And one of the most fascinating areas of science nowadays is neuroscience, the study of how the brain works. Now, the brain is an organ belonging to the human being. And like any other organ, it has an ontogeny and a phylogeny. That is to say, it develops from a little speck in the embryo to the 40 ounces you've got. And it has a phylogeny. It developed across eons through the normal processes of evolution. It dwells in a human body, and human beings are very social animals. Human beings are quintessentially social animals. And we now know from researchers in neuroscience that large parts of the brain are given over to processing social information. And one of these, this is a theory, it's not entirely proven, but it appeals to me, and I think it's probably on the right lines. One of these modules in the brain processing social information is the status module. Human beings in the native state, the state we developed in across hundreds of thousands of years, lived in small groups, about 100 to 150 in a group. And it was very important for the cohesion of the group for everybody to have an idea of where he was in the group pecking order. Who were the alpha males? You know? Who were the wise old women? And so on. So we have this status module in our brain that's constantly computing our status in the various groups we belong to. And it's come up amongst white Americans in the last 40 years or so that having the right opinions about race is a major status marker. A big status marker. And conversely, if you voice the wrong opinions about race, you can watch your status points swirling down the toilet. I've actually got a literary illustration of this, which I'd like to read you. This is from a novel by Tom Wolfe, one of our best modern social observers. And the novel was The Bonfire of the Vanities. And early in the book, I'm sure some of you must have read it, perhaps you recall, early in the book there's a young guy, a young district attorney, lower middle class, but very ambitious and thrusting, and his wife, living in an apartment in New York, and they've got a little baby. So they hire a nurse to take care of the baby. And being yuppies, of course, they go to an agency they've seen advertised in the New York Times. And the agency sends them a baby nurse who is English. And she's a real English baby nurse, a starched apron and the whole thing. This creates great psychic stress in their family, in their little apartment, because this woman who they've employed to look after their baby is an employee, obviously, and therefore they should outrank her in status. An employer should have higher status than an employee. But she's English. Now, it's a very peculiar thing, and I don't understand it, but it is a fact, I can tell you from experience, that you get extra status points in the United States for being English. Don't know why that's... Well, if you look at the origins of this country, it's pretty bizarre, but it is a fact. So here's this young yuppie couple in New York, and they've got this English nurse who they ought to be able to boss around, and they can't because she's English. And the psychic stress is terrible. And then, one day, I'm just going to read from the novel, one day the husband and the wife and the nurse are sitting watching TV, and there's a race riot on the TV. And they're watching this, and suddenly the nurse, the English nurse, passes some quite mildly anti-black remarks. She says something like, colored people don't know how good they've got it in this country. You know, something like that. Now I'll read you what Tom Wolfe says. And it's real Tom Wolfe. It's spot on social observation. Kramer and his wife looked at each other. He could tell she was thinking the same thing he was. Thank God in heaven. What a relief. They could let their breaths out now. Miss Efficiency was a bigot. These days, the thing about bigotry was it was undignified. It was a sign of low-rent origins, of inferior social status, of poor taste. So they were the superiors of their English baby nurse after all. What a fucking relief. I wish I could write like Tom Wolfe. But that's very good social observation. To have the wrong opinions about race is a terrific loser of status points. You're going to hemorrhage status points in whatever group you belong to, if you're a white person. I don't think it works this way with black Americans. I think you can have any kind of opinions about white people, and you're not going to lose status.
Oh, no, you can't like white people.
Oh, okay.
But hold on. Hold on. Now, I've stopped you.
All right.
You're right, because according to our self-appointed leaders, you are both bigots. Everyone in this room is a bigot. And, you know, because of slavery, Jim Crow, you know, I can't make it. So, just, you know, you can have any opinion in my community. You basically can't. Because we've been told this.
But you can't have the opinions that Clarence Thomas has and be an honored member of black society.
Well, don't get me wrong when I say this, and I'll have to use his language. Black leaders say Clarence Thomas is a fucking sellout. I mean, but, well, you know, I don't believe it because first of all,
my language, it was Tom Wolfe.
That's Tom Wolfe's language, but still, they say he's a sellout because he went to school, he achieved, he went on the Supreme Court. See, you have to be, for 90% of black Americans, and I'm sorry to intrude, we have been culturally conditioned to believe in victimization. I don't. Okay? I am just as good as anyone in this room. I fundamentally believe that. Okay? I don't give a damn what a study says, because first of all, studies, they'll tell you that a monkey decided to jump out of a tree one day, stood up, its hair and tail fell off, and it walked away mumbling to itself. I don't think so. Okay? I think there's a creator upstairs that created me and you. Now, hey, I mean, you know, I'm a sociopath, but hey, that's just in the bit.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry about that.
All right. So I'm just listing for you all the things that have gone wrong. And you know all the other things, this whole rickety apparatus of affirmative action, discrimination lawsuits, and corporate shakedowns, and profiling protests, and speech codes, and so on. It's not a pretty sight. And to those of us who can remember, oh dear, looking around this room, I may be the only one who can remember the ideals of the civil rights movement that were so inspiring, it's a horrible tragedy, horrible, bitter tragedy. I do acknowledge the things that have gone right, but so much has gone wrong. Mm-hmm. What do conservatives have to say about this? Well, I don't think it's unfair to summon up the mainstream conservative reaction to all this in two words. Silence and cowardice. First, silence. It's very difficult in a mainstream conservative gathering, and I spend half my evenings at them, let me tell you, it's very difficult to say anything about race. You could break wind at a conservative gathering, and you'd be forgiven. Like the Earl of Oxford. Everybody know the story about Queen Elizabeth I and the Earl of Oxford. The Earl of Oxford was presented to the Queen, and he made a great bow. And in making the great bow, he broke wind. So he was so mortified, he ran out of court and went off and colonized Jamaica or something. I don't know what he did. He was away for many years. I think he was away for 7 years. And then he came back and he was presented at court again. And Queen Elizabeth got up and walked forward to meet him and said, "My lord, we had forgot the fart." you can be forgiven for breaking wind in a conservative, mainstream conservative group, but you couldn't be forgiven for talking about race. It would be like, you know, the metaphor we all know about the switching on the kitchen light and the roaches all scattering and stuff. So there's silence, and it's not difficult to understand that. I don't blame mainstream conservatives for it. It's not difficult to understand, given what I said before about the history of this linking of racial injustice with conservatism and Republicans. The cowardice comes, I think, when conservatives, when mainstream conservatives do open their mouths. I would really rather they just kept silent. Because when they do open their mouths, like Karl Rove, what comes out is liberal orthodoxy. If you ask a mainstream conservative, you ask him, for example, about rates of black incarceration in jails, what are you going to hear? Oh, oppression, poverty, legacy of slavery, no opportunities, and so it's, you might as well be listening to a liberal. You're getting the victimology, you're getting the social engineering. The guy's conservatism just evaporated in front of your eyes. I say again, I'd really rather mainstream conservatives just kept their mouths shut, because when they open them, they make fools of themselves, and I say not only fools, but also cowards. There are some exceptions, I'm being a bit unfair. There are some mainstream or borderline mainstream conservatives, like, for example, Heather MacDonald, some of you perhaps know, who's done some very good stuff on racial profiling, and Ward Connolly, who's worked very hard and spent a lot of his own money and time on knocking down affirmative action programs. There are some, and I beg your pardon, Kevin Morton as well, who's done valiant work on this, but even there, you're really talking about borderline conservatives. These people are not going to be shaking hands with George W. Bush anytime soon. George W. Bush wouldn't touch them with a 10-foot pole. So, it's not a pretty picture. And I have, rather reluctantly, I have come to agree with Jared Taylor about one thing. That there is something going on here that liberal orthodoxy does not explain. I think we're going to find out much more about this in the near future. The human genome was decoded in 2003. And I keep in touch with these things. I'm in touch with a lot of very bright young geneticists. I live near Cold Spring Harbor Labs in Long Island, which is a center of this kind of work. And we're finding out quite astonishing things. I even wrote one up for National Review last year. I don't quite know where this is going to go, but there is something fundamental going on there. And I think we're at the point now where we can say, yes, there are group differences. There are group differences. What the quantity of them is, how much they're smothered and confused by things like poverty, by the things the liberal orthodoxy tells you about, I don't know. But I do think there's something fundamental there. But so what? Why does this spoil America? Why does this leave us stuck with this 60s, 70s model, this vast socially engineered structure? I don't think it needs to. I think if we speak more honestly to each other about these things, I think a lot of our fears will disappear. For example, now these truths, the truths that we're starting to dig out about human nature and about differences between human groups, unfortunately they're statistical, which is a very unhappy thing because the human brain isn't very good at coping with statistical information. I used to teach statistics, I know what I'm talking about here. I like to quote this little thought experiment. Imagine you're standing up in front of a room full of people, very much like this room full, none of whom is a trained statistician. And you say, on average, men are taller than women. I can almost guarantee that somebody in the room will stand up and say, what about Sally? She's taller than any of us. You see, people don't get statistics. You actually need some training. And human beings, I go back again to, human beings are social animals. The first thing we're always interested in is other people. People magazine has a much larger circulation. I haven't even looked up the numbers, but I'm sure it has a much larger circulation than the Journal of Statistical Abstracts. And I'm even willing to go out on a limb and say I think that will always be true. We're interested in people. Everybody can see Sally, but nobody can see a standard deviation. You have to work through some math to get to that. So these are statistical truths, and they're very difficult ones. But they can also be comforting ones. Let's suppose that Jared is right, and the black Americans score one standard deviation below white Americans on IQ tests. What does that mean? Well, one thing it means is that 6 million black Americans are smarter than the average white American. You see, you've got these overlapping bell curves. So you can do a half full, half empty thing, even with negative statistics like that. And so what? Suppose we manage to banish from the public sphere this idea that all groups must always be absolutely equal on all kinds of abilities. Suppose we banish that and we all say, yeah, groups have different kinds of abilities. Why would anybody care? Individually, as individuals, we're all quite at ease with our own mediocrity. I certainly am. I know that I stink at most things. My father was a very excellent tennis player, and I wasted 10 years of my life trying to be a tennis player, and I just couldn't do it. I don't have the hand-eye coordination. I stink. And I stink at a lot of other things, too. And even the things I don't stink at, I'm not very good at. The things I make my living at, writing, just in my personal acquaintance, I know half a dozen people who do it better than I do. And we're all like that. Very few of us are terrifically good at anything. Now, if we can live with our own individual mediocrity, as we all can't we? Why would any difference in groups hurt us or wound us in any way? Why? The groups are arbitrary anyway. Nobody gets to pick his ancestors. So I think we've got false fears. I think things have gone very badly wrong. I think we could put them right. And as an idealist about the United States, I hope we will put them right. And I do agree with Jared that the first step to putting them right is just to face facts and talk the truth to each other and discuss things with each other as we're doing here this evening and as the lefties tried their best to stop us doing.